We have assisting me in the Opani Department, my regular for this time of the day, during this time of the week, Mark Levine, a former congressional attorney and Washington, D.C. talk host on Pacifica Radio's WPFW. He's also host of the long-running television show The Inside Scoop. And you can learn more about Mark at www.marklevineradio.com. That's L-E-V-I-N-E, marklevineradio.com. Mark, good to have you back, buddy.
Thank you, Don. Good to be here. If I can give a plug, I'm hosting Leslie Marshall's show tonight and tomorrow from 7 to 10 Eastern Time. You can go to my website, marklevineradio.com. Great, fascinating story about teenage child abuse from institutions that are supposed to treat them for drugs. So if you're interested in that, I hope people will tune in.
Anybody who's ever loved anybody should be interested in that, and thanks for sharing that with us. Anyway, I want your reaction to what's happening in this regard. Congressman Engel out of New York is on record as saying one of the problems that Mr. Obama has is blaming Israelis as much as Palestinians for this impasse to peace. He thinks that this had a visceral effect on the folks in the 9th District, where, in fact, otherwise, there's a 3-to-1 majority of Democrats to Republicans. And, of course, it's a seat that the GOP hasn't had since 1923. Do you think Congressman Engel has a point?
I do, particularly for the 9th District. I mean, that is a high population of Orthodox Jews, a strong, supportive Israel population. And I do think that made a difference in a race that should normally have gone to the Democrats. Absolutely.
Well, now we're also looking at some other developments, and you got to wonder where we're headed with those. When we look at this particular race, and by the way, folks just joining us, we're talking about the 9th District of New York. They had the special election to replace the scandal-soaked Anthony Weiner. Conservative Republican Bob Turner prevailed over liberal Democrat Dave Wepperin by about 53-47%, saying throughout the campaign that the election would be a referendum on Obama's handling of the economy and his cooling position against Israel. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Congresswoman Schultz, also head of the Democratic National Committee, actually said it shouldn't be all that surprising that this district is a tough one for them. You know, they're now making believe that this shouldn't be at all surprising, but at the same time, they saw that they didn't have a chance to prevail in Nevada, so accordingly, they didn't bother allocating much in the way for that special election. But they allocated millions of dollars for this one. They brought in the big guns, Bill Clinton, Andrew Cuomo. Do you think Debbie Wasserman Schultz is perhaps guilty of less than genuine characterization?
Look, I'm a big fan of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and I have been for a long time. I think she was put in a tough position by this one. I do think it's a unique district.
But can't people just admit when they've had it wrong? Can't people admit when they had it wrong? Even if you like somebody, can't we expect people to? Because I've always found that you're going to have a lot more credibility with people when it comes to what you say you will do if you also have a history of acknowledging where you haven't been right.
I don't know whether you're talking about me or Debbie Wasserman.
No, I mean Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Like, the Associated Press tore her apart for her mischaracterization of Paul Ryan's Medicare approach. She was held accountable for it. But you don't have many instances of that. She doesn't have much of a history of ever being held accountable, especially by herself. And that's what I'm saying. Look, I've had on my show dozens of times former DNC chair Terry McAuliffe. Great guy. Obviously, he preached and propagated the views of the Democratic perspective, which you expect him to do. But the guy never really defended the indefensible and never tried to put one over the people in such a way as he knew he would be stretching credulity to the snapping point. But this woman, regardless of who her friends might be, doesn't seem to be anything like him in that regard. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, look, I like I told you, I do think that Israel mattered in this particular race. I do think it harmed Obama. I disagree with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I'm not going to give a flat attack on her. I like her for most things, and I agree with her on, I don't know precisely what she said about Paul Ryan's plan, but I do think Paul Ryan's plan would end Medicare as we know it, and so I'd probably agree with her there. But I do think on this particular issue, Obama is being hurt by a feeling among the Jewish community and, frankly, the larger pro-Israel community, which is larger than the Jewish community, that he is bending over backwards to be even-handed between Israel and the Palestinians, when, let's face it, Israel is a democratic ally. Palestinians are most of the blame. I won't say all the blame, but most of the blame, I think, for the impasse in the peace process.
Well, she was talking about the Paul Ryan plan. She was on record as attacking it as being an end to all things and that it was the worst thing to come on the horizon. But the strange thing that I've never been able to understand, and maybe you can help me understand this, President Obama and the Democratic leadership generously praised President Obama's debt commission. Generously. We're talking about Erskine Bowles, Senator... who's the senator from Wyoming? Help me out with that.
Alan Simpson.
Simpson, thank you. Both Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles were very complimentary of the Ryan plan. So I'm wondering, how can Democrats credibly vilify the Ryan plan, as Debbie Wasserman Schultz did, after it so highly praised the commission about which Democrats spoke so well? I mean, here you have a debt commission that speaks highly of the Ryan plan. You have all Democrats speaking well of the debt commission. So why is it the Democrats are going to attack the very thing that was talked of highly by the very people they admire? A little disconnected, is it not?
Alan, if I tried to argue what you did just now, you would say that is clear, faulty logic and doesn't follow Socratic method and all of that. You can't say that because you praise people on one thing and then those same people praise someone else on a different thing, that you support the person on a different thing. Come on, Alan, you know that's faulty logic. The Debt Commission was not praised for its praise of the Ryan Plan. They were praised for making hard decisions on the deficit. The Ryan Plan does end Medicare as we know it, and most Americans like Medicare, which is why most Americans have given the Republican Party the lowest approval rating they have gotten in probably in decades. It's down to 33%. Congress has a 10% approval rating precisely for approving things like the Ryan Plan. Come on, Alan.
Yeah, but the debt commission, the very folks about which Democrats spoke so highly, themselves praised him. It got 14 votes of the 18 necessary to make it more binding law. They were going to agree to vote. It got a majority vote, but not enough. Not quite enough. Even Durbin agreed with it. He voted for it. No stranger to left-wingedness. Look, what I'm saying is both Erskine Bowles and Al Simpson, both Bowles and Simpson, Democrat and Republican, came out and said the following. I'm not kidding. Quote, "The budget released by House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan is a serious, honest, straightforward approach to addressing our nation's enormous fiscal challenges. We applaud him for his work in putting forward a proposal which will reduce the country's deficit by approximately the same amount as the plan of the president's fiscal commission." So you got the president and the Democrats applauding the debt commission applauding the Ryan plan, and yet those same Democrats vilify the very thing approved by the people they otherwise embrace. I'm sorry, there's a disconnect there whether you want to acknowledge it or not.
Well, Alan, first of all, you switched topics on me, so I don't have their statement in front of me, but I did read the entire statement of the Debt Commission. As I recall, they attacked Paul Ryan's plan pretty fiercely. They said it was a serious plan. That's the praise that you read. And then in the next paragraph, which you're not reading, they attacked it fiercely for ending Medicare. So you need to give the full story out.
No, they acknowledge that he does not end Medicare. That's the fallacy right there. He modifies it, he amends it, but he does not end it. And it's rather disingenuous for people to say, oh, you know, the consequences for wrongdoing are too much. Therefore, that should be the grounds for not stopping it. I don't buy it. America doesn't buy it, nor should you. Folks, stick with us. You are with Battleline, Main Street Radio Network. I'm Alan Nathan. I have a system in the opining. One of my regulars for this time of the week, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney and Washington, D.C. radio host on Pacifica Radio's WPFW. I can learn more about Mark at marklevineradio.com. He also is an often guest host for Leslie Marshall. Mark, good to have you back, buddy.
Thanks.
I want to talk about Rick Perry a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of folks were excited about him. The Tea Party, in part, used to be excited about him. But then again, this is the I've never in my life, as a former national television correspondent, longtime talkist, I've never in my life before witnessed a group's persona having such a disconnect with who they actually are. But anyway, it seemed that Rick Perry was first resonating effectively with the Tea Party because he was actually one of the first premier Republican politicians to acknowledge them. But now he's come across with something that is actually quite alienating to a lot of folks in the Tea Party, and that is his position on illegal immigration. This guy has essentially signed into law one that allows illegal immigrants to have in-state tuition rates for college, thus ensuring plenty of Americans wind up paying more than they do. Now, folks might be scratching their head, well, how does that happen? Well, this happens when Americans are charged more for being students from out of state. Of course, the paradox is that the illegals paying less are actually from out of country. So let me ask you, will this eventually perhaps lead to Romney overtaking Perry?
I don't know that that's the issue that most people oppose Rick Perry on. You're right that it bothers people in the Tea Party, although a number of governors give in-state tuition to kids growing up all their lives in a state but happen to, through no fault of their own, been brought over from a foreign country when they were infants or small children.
A tertiary measure, not the primary one. I don't know why it's always used as an excuse. Telling me what a thing is not does not excuse what a thing is. So in that respect, we're still violating the law. I mean, that's the perfect recipe for violating any and all laws. Just characterize them as somehow not being helpful to what would be a higher principle and accordingly disobey it. Right now we have sanctuary cities all around the country violating laws.
I don't know too many laws blame a child for their father's sin. I mean, that's one of the things the Bible says, right? Don't blame a kid for the sins of the fathers.
Nobody is. If you deny a criminal's offspring the booty of their ill-gotten gain, that is not attacking the kid. Look, every day we're putting criminals in jails and taking things from them that hurt their family. We're not expected to tell the judiciary is never expected to do something about the kids who might be marginalized because of the misadventures of their parents. Why is it in this particular venue? We are.
I can't think of another example in the law where we punish a child for the actions of their fathers.
How are we punishing them? You are simply denying them that which would not have been theirs had their parents not broke the law to begin with. You're using a tertiary measure instead of the primary one.
We have two kids who've grown up in Texas since they were two. Okay, one was brought over illegally by their parents from Mexico. The kid, it too, obviously had no choice in the matter. Another was brought to Texas from their parents by Oklahoma when they were two. The two kids grow up, they only speak English, they're exactly similar in every other way, and now we're saying that the child has to suffer for the sins of the parents.
By your measure, nobody ever has to be held accountable for anything ever again if it turns out that punishment will by default harm their children. We don't do that with any other kind of breaking of the law, yet you want to do it here. Look, you can't use your own, a family cannot use its own original mistake as a legitimate excuse for the ones that are subsequently triggered by it. For instance, you could never tell your boss, hey, sorry for not getting that report to you this afternoon, but it was only because I was late to work this morning. By your measure, any time a criminal is punished, we should pull our punches before law enforcement because we may find the children of that criminal's family marginalized because of the punishment that will be duly inflicted upon that criminal. Right now, you're giving the perfect recipe to ensure that no illegal immigrant nor anybody who gives them safe harbor ever has to be punished again, because by punishing them, by default, the kids will be punished.
What you're saying is that if a child goes to a teacher and says, sorry, I didn't get my homework done last night, my father died, or my father was very sick, if the teacher were then to punish the child by giving them a bad grade because their father died, we would see that as a pretty cruel, awful human being of a teacher, because it's not the kid's fault that their father died. This is similar to that situation.
So you're going to take a peripheral observation, infer it as if it were a conclusive analysis, and then accordingly convey it as such? That's not going to pass the laugh test. You can't, by your measure, you could take any argument, expand it into a multitude of other arguments, essentially allowing you to escape from your half of the original rub. Why? Because you couldn't defend it. Your approach, your recipe ensures that we never get to make these laws binding. And that's a very cruel thing to do to a society, because we're all supposed to be equal under the law, which means people hear the phrase, oh, we're a nation of laws, not men. They don't understand that what that actually means is that the law being violated always matters more than the person's doing the violating, or the character, or the personality. We can't start pulling our punches on law enforcement predicated on the race and ethnicity of the people in question. You start doing that, and you open up a whole nest of problems, do you not?
Alan, I didn't talk about age, race or ethnicity, but I did talk about age. Let me give you an example. Under the law, if you are under the age of 7, you are not considered criminally responsible at all. I'll give you an example. If you're a 6-year-old and you murder someone, you take a gun and you shoot someone at the head, the law says, you know what?
You're not punishing them. You are simply denying them that which they never would have had anyway but for their parents' breaking of the law. That's what you're missing here. And unfortunately, we have the best possible solution within our reach, but nobody wants it because they'd rather keep it alive as an issue. I say the most Solomonic approach is to ensure the following. Upon sealing up the border, let's immediately have pathways to citizenship. I've spoken to a lot of people from both sides of the aisle, from both sides of this perspective, and that seems to be resonating more and more with folks I meet. That way,
I firmly support pathways to citizenship, but I don't think we can seal up the border. And neither, by the way, does Rick Perry. It's not a question of sealing. You don't hermetically seal a 2,000-mile border. It's not possible. I'm okay with having greater.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. You know, you're not the only one saying that. That the fence isn't practical because it would be too long. Given that we have tens of thousands of miles of barriers, fences, and walls throughout the country, what makes him or you think that a couple of thousand miles of barrier building is somehow beyond the scope of our nation's already existing and often replicated success in this area? We've done this before. We've done this before. You're going to tell me that we can have tens of thousands of miles of barriers, fences, and walls in this country, but we're unable to pretty much do that along the border? You know, that's sad, because a slight majority of Americans are okay with pathways to citizenship, but at the same time, over 70% in poll after poll after poll, and you don't get there unless you have both conservatives and liberals feeling similarly about this, but you don't get the 70% without that reality, but still 70% are saying, we want to seal up the border first. Now, sealing up the border, it doesn't have to be hermetically, but right now the GAO says 49% of our border is unprotected. That's too much, Mark. Why don't we bring it up to 90% and then say, let's have pathways to citizenship, or 95%, something. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
As you know, President Obama has done at least twice as much to border enforcement as George Bush. But here's why I want you to ask these people in the poll. Ask that 70% if they'd be willing to raise their taxes 10% to pay for that wall. I think you'll find that 70% will soon dip to 10%. People don't think it's worth it that much. Sure, they want it if it's free, but it's not free, Alan. It's not free.
What's also not free is doing the slovenly job that we've done thus far, because not protecting the border has culminated into costs that are demonstratively burdensome to all the border states.
What cost? The costs, it seems to me, are lesser now than they were under George Bush.
Predicated on what? You're just coming up with stuff out of the blue. Predicated on what? No, you made an assertion on this show. When assertions are made, they're premised on grounds. So what are the grounds upon which you're making these assertions?
Obama has deported twice the number of people of George Bush. He has done more than twice the border guards. He has done more than twice the amount of enforcement. And I don't remember conservatives complaining under George Bush. So it's
they were always complaining. Actually, that was one of his biggest problems, the complaint over that. I don't see why the following two things are mutually exclusive. Go ahead and secure the border and then have pathways to citizenship. This way, both groups are getting what they want, but they're getting it in a fashion that makes sense. Right now, what you have is administration, and they made it clear to Senator Kyle of Arizona. They said, when asked, why won't you just secure the border, Obama told Senator Kyle, well, we can't do that all the way because then you won't be motivated to go along with comprehensive immigration reform. Well, I'm sorry, buddy, as far as I'm concerned, the enforcement of existing law should never be contingent upon the passage of new. Do you really disagree with me on that?
You say, why don't you just secure the border? If it were as easy as why don't you just brush your teeth? Securing the border is something that can never be done perfectly. You admit that.
Predicated on what? I never have admitted that. No, on the contrary, I have effectively disabused you of that assumption because I pointed out in this country we have tens of thousands of miles of roads, barriers, and walls. To assert that we can't do a couple of thousand miles in a comparatively straighter line is bizarre. But anyway, as per the norm, never enough time. Mark Levine, ladies and gentlemen, check out his website, marklevineradio.com. You are with Battleline, Main Street Radio Network. I'm Alan Nathan.